Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
All right, Marco.
Sean, ready for a good chat?
Ready for a bit of collaboration today.
Yeah, don't we all want that?
Yes.
Don't we all want that?
It would be nice if we come together and work together on everything.
Get along and instead of reinventing the wheel a lot as we go, to learn from what others have been doing, right or wrong, and move on. But that's my ideal city, and I don't know if we're there yet.
I think we're working towards that. Working towards that goal.
Let's say that. But we're talking about the cyber society.
Yep. And there's a nod to ISSA International. We've been doing a series of luminaries conversations, and we have another amazing person joining us today for this cyber society discussion. And that is Mark Weatherford. Mark, thanks so much for being part of this.
Thanks, Sean and Marco. Happy to be here with you guys today.
Yeah. And by now, we normally would have seen you in a lot of different places around the country. And instead, we're recording a podcast. So for our audience, they're not going to see us, but we can at least see each other. So that's it's very nice to...
You know, it's funny you say that because we have ran into each other. I think I can't even count the times where we're walking down the hall or we're sitting in a pub or something and we run into each other.
Yeah,
exactly. That's the beauty of this industry and this community.
And we sure miss that. But, it's going to come back. It's going to come back. No questions about it.
It will come back.
Yeah. So
and when it does, what's that going to look like? That's the question. Right? How do we get there?
It's going to look a little bit different, I think. It's going to retain a little bit of what we have learned and a little bit of the need to go back to human one-on-one relationship.
People missed it.
Right?
People miss collaborating, miss having a drink together, miss going to dinner.
That's part of being human.
So we're all having to find new ways to connect with each other. And I think one of the main things we want to talk about today is this idea of a common goal or a common mission, and whether or not different entities in society share a common goal or mission. And Mark, you've had a number of roles in the private sector, a number of roles in the public sector. You've seen a lot, and you advise companies that cross both as well. And I think the first question, maybe to kick it off, is what is the difference in terms of common goal, common mission between, well, let's just stick with public and private sector as two big buckets?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of differences, but and without sounding too trite about it, I think, the biggest in a public company, you don't, or a public organization, public sector organization, you don't have the same kind of revenue pressures that you have in a private sector company. In a private sector company, you're absolutely focused on, the next quarter or the next year of revenues to stay in business, to make sure that your shareholders are happy and that you still have jobs and all of your employees still have jobs next year. And a little bit of a different focus in the public sector. Governments obviously don't have those kind of revenue or financial concerns, but they do have speaking purely from a cyber perspective, you know, they do have concerns around the securing and the of public information and the privacy of citizens. And, you know, I used to say this when I was CISO in California that, you know, citizens can choose to go to, you know, their local retailer or their local travel agent or their local whatever and share with them private information and private financial information. Citizens can't make those same kind of yes, no decisions about what they're going to share with the government. You know, the government has access to a lot of very sensitive information, healthcare information, driving information, financial and tax information. So the government has a much higher level of responsibility, in my opinion, to protect citizen privacy and citizen security related information. So that's really the biggest difference there, you know, and you have where in you know, in a private company, you have the board that's kind of looking at your broader risk of the company. In the government, you have really the legislature or, you know, the regulators that are providing that same kind of a risk function and thinking of, you know, the thinking about a much broader constituency than just shareholders. You know, they're thinking about all of the citizens that belong within that government organization. So really it is I mean, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of security, we're doing the same thing, but the mission and drivers of those are considerably different.
I love where you really give a really nice pictures of that. And the question is, sometimes the perception of the government in general is that it's much slower than the market. You have to find agreement. Politics is called the art of compromise, at least by philosopher in the past. And also, as you said, it's not just so as easy to make a decision when you have to report what you do to the people that put you there in a democracy, ultimately. So some people, I may feel like it's hard to take technology and place it into the government, except or when you're thinking maybe military, when you're thinking about grid, energy and infrastructure. But the truth is that nowadays technology is pervading everything. I mean, look at the election. That's been part of that as well, that conversation. So how does it look from that side of the barricade when you've got to bring technology to serve democracy and protect all the citizens versus being on the other side, which is commercially, is this a valuable product? Let's go for it.
Yeah, well, I think to the very first part, is government is just by its very nature is slower to react than the private sector for a whole lot of reasons. You know, I mean, there's less urgency because, because there's not the revenue drivers that a public company has to meet numbers every quarter or every year. Not that same kind of urgency to do that. And it's funny. I just actually wrote an article on this issue and on this issue with respect to technology, and very very specifically what I was talking about was I talked about technology debt, tech debt, and while tech debt is an issue in the public and the private sector, I think, you know, in the public sector we're starting to see more challenges to address this tech debt and this issue of legacy systems that continue to exist and we're not investing to recover and implement new technology. There's a report, I can't give it attribution because I can't remember what it was, but in the federal government, across all federal agencies, they spend about 80% of all of their IT budget supporting 20% of the technology. because of this technology debt. And so when you think about that, and you mentioned a second ago, you mentioned the pandemic. You know, one of the biggest challenges that, and not just in government, well, but yeah, primarily in government, as a result of the pandemic, is many of the state governments, their unemployment compensation benefits application systems are systems that were developed 30 years ago. They're still written in COBOL. So one of the technology challenges, as more and more, you know, as the unemployment rate skyrocketed in April and May, you know, these unemployment systems were just inundated, and states were having trouble finding COBOL programmers because they don't make them anymore. COBOL programmers to come in and you know, be part of working on these systems and applications. So you know, I think. And not to say that tech debt doesn't exist in the private sector, because it certainly does. I mean, I've been in several companies where we said, you know, we just have to live with this on this old system, you know, for another year because we can't afford to upgrade it right now. But, you know, and I've often thought about this. This is, you know, if you think about I may be getting off track here, but bear with me for a second. You know, if we think about technology in business and in government, it was really only like 25 years ago, mid-90s, where governments and private sector companies said, hey, let's use computers. Let's start building databases. Let's start building all these technology applications. It's only been 25 years since we really have gone all in on technology in government and private sector. But while both the government and private sector have reaped the benefits of technology, they have been reluctant to spend money on securing that technology. So it was almost like, you know, we should have said at the very beginning, said, if you're going to spend, you know, $1,000 on technology, you have to budget $100 for security. You have to budget, you know, it's like if you're in a manufacturing company, you every year you're budgeting, you're setting aside a little bit of money for next year. You know, you've got to buy new technology, or you've got to, you know, you've got to refresh something. We haven't done that with our information technology resources. We haven't set aside this little pool of money that says, okay, in 5 years, when this thing is at its end of life and we have to replace it, we kind of do it year by year by year by year. And it's, and obviously, you know, when you have some of these really big numbers to replace some of these systems, it's very easy, especially in the government, to say, nah, let's just live with this for another year.
And Mark, this is an interesting point here, perhaps, because you're talking, say you have $1,000, you need to set aside 100. The first thing that came to mind was, is that 100 out of the 1,000, or is that 100 in addition to the 1,000? And that raised the question for me, I was thinking, doesn't the government have some leverage to say, if you want to do business with us, you will sell us something that is already secure. So we want that $100 security built in. And it was, as you were talking previously, I was wondering.
If it was that easy, Sean. Oh, my God.
I know. Can it be that easy? Is that something we should strive for? Because I was just thinking, is the government the right team, quote unquote, to implement technology and implement security, or should they look to experts and professionals to do that on their behalf? So they're rather looking at, what do we need to provide the citizens, and we look for somebody who can do that for us securely as well. So two different angles there. But
there's so many ways I could talk about this. Let me, one of them, and this is the issue of centralization, organizational centralization of security. So this is a bigger problem in government than it is in the private sector, but it exists everywhere. And the issue is that, so let me give you an example. And when I was a CISO for the state of California, there were over 140 agencies, boards, councils, commissions, departments, et cetera. And every one of these organizations had their own security leader. Sometimes they're called a CISO. Sometimes they weren't. They had their own security teams. They had their own security budgets. They had their own security technologies. Well, in every one of these, and they were buying their own stuff. In one agency, they might be buying one product, and another agency to buy a different product that both did the same thing. So you can see how this the permutations of spending just get completely out of control. So the challenge there is the government, I mean, centralization, and I've been an advocate for centralization for a long, long time. As technologies converge, I think organizations need to converge as well. You know, for and most private companies have solved this now or are solving it, taking their IT leaders and budgets and their OT and their even physical security, and they're saying, okay, this is all going to fall under the umbrella of security, and the security people are going to manage all these different subcomponents of it. The government hasn't done that. A lot of private companies haven't done it, but there is a definite trend to the convergence of security now, which the beauty here is that it allows organizations to figure out where their most risk is and apply the resources to that risk. So whether the risk is physical security or IT security, whether it's databases or two-factor authentication, because there's thousands of different things that we worry about as security professionals. But by converging and having establishing relationships between these organizations that may have never worked together before, you're able to prioritize your overall organizational risk a lot better than you can when you have silos or all over the place.
Well, if you allow me, as you're describing this, also seems to me that you can move from that reactive mentality to a proactive mentality, because you're not just waiting every year to look at the budget and see what needs to be done. Let's patch this, let's patch that. And, you know, but we got to save money here and there. So, and also the fact that you're collaborating, it may allow you to save that budget because somebody already made that commitment that works, that operation that worked, that action that worked. Because in the end, I think the big question is, what drives all of this, right? So is the welfare of all the citizen? I hope that's what the driver is. But that's a very It's a very big generic statement. Like, you know, everything could be that. So how do you prioritize when you are with such a limited budget like that?
Well, a great question. And I'll say we as a community have not done that well. And I include myself. You know, I've been in this. Here's the problem is we talk about strategy and creating, you know, strategic plans for, you know, 2-3 years down the road. But the reality is, and I'm going to say something here. It's a little bit, I'm drawing a black and white kind of picture, but I don't mean it to be, because there's a lot of gray in there. But, you know, I call it the Fortune 500 and the unfortunate 5,000. You know, if you're in the Fortune 500, you typically have a lot of money. You typically have enough money, enough resources to that you have flexibility. You can, as your risk posture changes throughout the year, you can say, okay, I need to divert resources over here. If you're in the unfortunate 5,000, you're struggling to keep up on an annual basis anyway. So going back to the strategic, you know, we talk about having strategic plans, but the reality is most of us, we resort to being tactical, because the tactical issues are the biggest problems. You know, these are the bad guys biting at our heels on a daily basis. These are a new vulnerability popped up today this needs to be fixed right now. Or a new regulation came out that I need to go figure out how it applies to my company. So we deal with a lot of these, we have to deal with a lot of these tactical issues, And unless you have enough resources, these tactical issues divert you away from thinking strategically, of being able to plan 3 years in advance for resources and budgeting and things like that. And again, this is not a criticism. This is just the reality of most CISOs and most security organizations. They find themselves on a daily basis dealing with tactical problems.
Yeah, and Mark, so maybe a look into the future a bit here, because we've touched on collaboration a little bit, and clearly not everybody's going to be in a place where they can be strategic. And so most of us are forced to be tactical, right? There's that thing we implemented, it's changed, we have to keep it up and running, we have to maintain security, we're building a new business line route or something, and we have to stand a new system up or a new cloud up. And that's all very tactically driven. So how do we, as a community, perhaps, because I my sense is we're not even doing the tactically well, right? So some of us are missing the basics there even. So I'm wondering how the community can come together, and are there organizations, we obviously know one, maybe you can touch on it, ISSA, to help each other as professionals, at least do well with the tactical from a collaboration perspective, versus constantly being behind the eight ball.
Yeah, well, so a couple things. The good news is I think we're getting better at security, and we're getting better because technology is helping us get better. And I've been saying this for 10 years, that I think technology will help us solve the problems that we've dug our way into by implementing technology. But, you know, going back to the organizational piece, you know, I think I joined, I could probably find it out. I think I joined ISSA in like 2003. I joined the group, actually maybe it was earlier than that. I don't remember. But so I joined ISSA in I think it was in San Diego at the time. Then I moved to Colorado Springs. And the group here was such, it was, I remember going to a meeting, a first meeting, monthly meeting of our ISSA chapter. And I thought, holy cow, this is the most mind-blowing experience that I've had, because you have all of these really smart people from a wide variety of industries, from the space industry, from the military industry, from just this huge diversity of experience, and the group, honestly, I mean, the monthly meetings were just fascinating, because typically have, you know, a guest speaker to come in, and anyway, and, you know, not to become, you know, a pimp for ISA, but it was really a good group, and that exists to today. You know, I mean, you look at what ISSA is doing, they're pulling people in from this diversity of organizations, and everybody is both able to contribute a little bit, but also take a little bit out. And I think this is what makes ISSA such a wonderful organization. And you look across the nation at the different ISSA local chapters in different cities, and almost everybody I know belongs to one of those local chapters somewhere. So, you know, ISSA, I think, has been kind of one of the foundational organizations for security, for me anyway, and from my perspective anyway, that has helped us as a profession mature over the years.
Yeah, and Mark, I think it's important, because all of that was you consuming the value of the organization. And I want to point out that you continuously give back a tremendous amount to the community, a lot through ISSA. I can't count the number of CISO forums I've seen you speak at. And the conversations that you have there in those groups have been phenomenal. And I think it's a chance for people to come together to hear from folks like yourself about the experiences you're having, the challenges you're facing, the work that you've done. And so I guess, how important is it that others step up and do similar things like you?
Well, that's a great question. I was going to go there, so I'm glad you asked it. You know, I've been doing this stuff for 30 years now. My whole adult life, you know, has been in security. And I'm not going to be around forever. I'm not going to continue. I'm not going to, one of these days, I hope to ride off into the sunset. But if you look at our community, there's a lot of people that are in the same situation as me. People that have, you know, that are in their 50s and 60s now that are the gray beards of the organization. And one of the things that we do talk about a lot, in fact, we write about it a lot, is that we have part of our responsibility is to make sure that the next generation of security professionals kind of has the tools at their disposal to begin leading this profession. And it's a little bit, I'll tell you, it's being a CISO today is so much harder than when I was first a CISO. You know, I think I could legitimately call myself a semi-expert in security back in 2003. I wouldn't even begin to call myself an expert in security today. There's so much technology. There's so many laws and regulations. What a person has to know to be called an expert today, I think there's probably very few people that really are, you know, quote unquote experts. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of very qualified people. But they're qualified in, you know, more broadly instead of more specifically. You can still be a very specific technology expert, but you may not be a regulatory expert. So it really is important. I think maybe the most important, and, you know, my good friend Nils Pullman and I talk about this a lot, is how do we work together to make the next generation capable of dealing with a much more complex security world than we did, you know, when we got into the business 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the next generation, because that was my rep. And so thank you for passing. Thank you for passing the ball. Now, I have
just
to say,
just quickly though, because Neil, we talked about organization. So ISSA is one we mentioned, but Neil's was the founder of CSA, Cloud Security Alliance.
Well, you definitely need more organizations. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Look, here's what I think you said. You know, I mean, an expert, you know, knows a lot about one thing and probably not much about a lot of things. And it has become so complex, this field, that you do need so many much more expertise. And so as a CISO, I feel like more we talk with them more and more, it's like you're the catalyzer. You're the meaning point of, you know, the legal, the market, the business understanding, the technology, the cybersecurity, and so forth. So, I mean, asking somebody to be an expert in all of that seems a little bit too much. But what you guys have been doing, you've been inventing the profession. And I don't know if it was that easier. It was just different. But taking that experience and being able to help the new up-and-coming professional, because as you said, they're going to be the one having that on their shoulder, maybe with a different culture, a different perspective. I mean, Sean and I, sometimes we joke, and we're probably going to do a podcast about this on Remember When, right? The dial-up modem or, you know, the rotary phone, and thinking about the kids today, the teenager today, they're probably going to be 30 years from now and say, hey, remember when we had the smartphone? Because maybe in 30 years, there's not even the smartphone, you know, as a gadget anymore. So who knows? But what you've been doing, it's amazing. And I want to thank you for that, and ISSA for this. And I think sometimes we're just a little too quick to judge as users of technology and pointing the finger to the government and we don't understand how much they have to struggle with. I think we got to keep sharing. I think we got to keep building and collaborating. That's the most important thing.
I was just going to say, you know, I think, you know, one thing, you're right, that a lot has changed, but this is a hard business we're in, you know, and just because you have a job description that says, you know, that you do A through Z, I guarantee you tomorrow you're going to wake up and there's going to be something on your list that is not in your job description that you have to deal with. Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of what we try, you know, as we convey to this next generation to say, you just got to be creative. You've got to be adaptable and you've got to be able to deal with anything. I mean, what if tomorrow morning you wake up and you have a ransomware event? Okay. You know, there's, you have a list of steps you need to go by, but there's never a security incident that's the same as the one somebody else had. So they're all different and they're all going to require a little bit of different decision-making. So being able to think through these things and consciously make decisions that may not be written down anywhere, I think are some of the, it's maybe one of the greatest skill of a security professional today.
Excellently stated, of course. And Mark, I'm going to take this moment to thank you personally for your time today. Thank you personally for your continued friendship. After the community, thanks for all that you do to help raise awareness and bring people together and have the conversations that everybody needs to have to continue to grow and hopefully survive in this ever-changing world.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. Thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and the story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.